From KCUR, I'm Steve Kraske, and this is Up to Date. Pulitzer Prize winner Michael Chabon's novels have taken readers to a world of comics in World War II-era New York and posed an alternative history where Jews fleeing the Holocaust settle in Alaska. This hour, we'll discuss his latest story, which explores the lives of people running an independent record store in California. We'll also find out how he gets his inspiration and what keeps him writing at all hours of the night. Later, Brian McTavish returns with the weekend to-do list. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. Michael Chabon's latest book, Telegraph Avenue, has been described as a movie, a TV show, an album, and just maybe the book that it is. Whatever it is, it appears to be working, as Telegraph Avenue has earned sterling reviews for its deep dive into art, race, and sexuality. The book centers on a pair of struggling couples. The men, one black and one white, are partners in a vinyl record store. The women work together as nurse midwives. And there's a whole lot of stuff going on here. Michael Chabon was last on this program in 2009 talking about his book, Manhood for Amateurs, The Pleasures and Regrets of a Husband, Father, and Son. And Michael, welcome back.
Thanks, Steve. It's great to be here.
You said once that the inspiration for this book was the lost utopia that never quite happened. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think I was talking specifically about the place I grew up, which was Columbia, Maryland.
Yes.
A planned community that was built in the farmland, old tobacco farmland between Baltimore and Washington, D.C., starting in the mid-60s. And it was intended from the start to be this quasi-utopian place where it was open to everyone, regardless of race or religious background or economic ability. And there was open classrooms in the schools, and public transportation was free, and there were footpaths. And
Sounds wonderful.
It was an amazing place, and it really did, for about the first 10 years of its existence, it held fairly close to its stated ideals before inexorably sort of getting absorbed into the greater sprawl of that part of the world.
And what do you recall about that? Were you disappointed when that happened, or were you still around when that
happened? That was as I was leaving. It was right around just after I left to go off to college. It was really starting in the early 80s that the real estate market went bananas in the D.C. area, and Columbia just couldn't hold out any longer.
You know, I think lots of folks are looking for that utopia, in suburban America or downtown Kansas City in the new loft, condos and that kind of thing. Is anybody finding it, do you think?
Well, I mean, I think we've been looking for it, pretty much since we came down from the trees. It's wired into so many, mythologies and religions, the idea of, the New Jerusalem or, the city on the hill. This idea that if we could just start over with everything that we've learned, everything we know that works and doesn't work, or if we follow these principles or those principles, we could make this place that works, that is, the perfect place to live in. I think it's just inherent in human nature, and we keep trying over and over again. And, of course, I think as I wrote in that same piece that you were quoting from, it's in the nature of utopia to go out of business. I mean, you can't sustain it because we're flawed and imperfect, and all the places that we are ever going to create will also be flawed.
And there's disappointment always wrapped up in it somehow, too. People who listen to this show know I'm a big fan of the Andy Griffith Show, or at least I used to be when my kids were little. Mm-hmm. We would watch that show, and I'm on some blog that talks about the show, and invariably, over the years, people write in, Mayberry was great, but there weren't any African Americans there. And, there was this issue, and there was this issue, and even Mayberry sort of had its problems.
Right. Or they were just hidden away or glossed over or whatever it might be. Yeah. You can only, it doesn't mean, but I think the important thing is just because in advance it isn't going to work in all likelihood is no reason not to go ahead and try it.
Mm-hmm.
Because you get things out of the effort, even things you might not have foreseen or anticipated.
You know, you talk in the full quote that you gave about this utopia thing. You said, I found myself obliged and eager to recreate through fiction, through storytelling and prose, the lost utopia that never quite happened, that I never quite knew, and I have never since forgotten, and that I have been losing and longing for all my life. I mean, it's a great line.
Thank you.
And again, we're all longing for it to some degree.
Of course.
You know, and yeah, you just can't quite reach it.
I mean, that was the thing, having grown up in Colombia at this time when it was really solidly committed to being racially integrated. And, you know, it was basically black and white. Those were the races concerned at that point. When I came to Oakland, California, to the East Bay about 16 years ago.
And you still live there now?
And that's where I live now.
Right. Mm-hmm.
You know, I had this immediate sense of comfort and familiarity with the racial diversity of the place. Now, talk about imperfect places. I mean, I love living in the East Bay. I love Oakland. It's one of my favorite cities in the world. I love living in Berkeley. But there are all kinds of problems, and racial problems are right at the top of the list of problems that Oakland's faced for, you know, more than a half a century now. And yet it's also truly diverse. And when you go out, we go to a restaurant, you go to the movies, you go anywhere, you're surrounded by all kinds of different people, and not just black people and white people, but people from all over the world. And that's where I feel comfortable. That's where I feel at home. And for me, I guess home incorporates a certain sense of strife or difficulty. I mean, that's what a family, there's no such thing. The family, in a way, is the ultimate flawed utopia because, you know, we all have this ideal of being this loving, tender, affectionate family. And
it is
most
sometimes.
Of us try. And
we sometimes, get there occasionally.
Yeah, we succeed. But, you know, but you can't be thrown off or discouraged or dissuaded of the value of the effort by the fact that a lot of times it doesn't work at all. And there is strife and there is discontent and people do lose their tempers and all that stuff. It doesn't mean it's not worth doing.
Author Michael Chabon is our guest. So how does this notion of utopia, how does it play into Telegraph Avenue, which is, I guess, now out in paperback and which is bringing you around the country right now? So how does utopia play into this book and what are you trying to get at there?
Well, all those sort of vague feelings of familiarity or comfort that I had on arriving in the East Bay in the late 90s crystallized for me one day when I walked into
I
walked into a used record store in Oakland, and I was on the market for an idea. I had to come up with an idea for a television series at that point for TNT, and I walked into this used record store, and on this particular day there happened to be two guys working in the store, and one was a black guy and one was a white guy. And they had a bunch of customers standing around, leaning on the front counter, and they were just, you know, shooting the breeze and teasing each other and mostly talking about music and talking about records. And those customers were black guys and white guys, and they were old and they were young. And that little dusty, you know, kind of moldy smelling place was, it seemed to be like the heart of that idea of utopia that I had grown up with, you know, that I guess I define it as a place where people come to be together because they want to be with people who share the value of coming together and being together regardless of their differences.
And, you know, and I read that story that you talked about, that moment that gave rise to Telegraph Avenue, and I immediately thought about a place in Westport here in Kansas City and a place called Streetside Records, which was the dusty old sort of, you know, the record place where you went, you know, and it closed a few years ago, and I miss it profoundly to this day. I drive by that place and think, you know, it's gone, and you go there, and I was always diving downstairs into the jazz section, and there would always be, you know, guys there to talk to you about the music. And hey, if you like this Coltrane thing, you'll like this thing. And God, I love that. I love the smell of that basement. I loved everything about it. And you worry so much that those kinds of places aren't going to be around a whole lot longer, which I guess is sort of what you're driving at here, with a used record store being the place you're talking about.
Right. I mean, and I mean, that's, you know, what I was saying. It is in the nature of utopia to go out of business. It happened to Streetside Records, too.
Yeah.
But, you know, it is – it can be frightening to contemplate the possibility that, you know, as big box stores and discount retailers and online shopping and all of those things, you know, continue to just grow and proliferate and take over, that there's just going to be no room for – a place like the record store you're describing, Streetside, or the little mom and pop, any kind of stores.
It ain't happening at Barnes & Noble in the basement on, in the plaza where the music is. Those conversations aren't happening there.
No.
It's not too much.
I mean,
you know?
it could. It's not
it
impossible.
Could.
It depends on who's staffing the place.
It does sometimes,
But, you know, that desire, I would like to believe that the desire that we have for those kinds of places will ensure that they continue to, you know, be open. And I mean, at least at this moment, I see a lot of reason to be, you know, confident about that or sanguine about that. You know, in my part of the world, literally the week that my book came out last year in hardcover, a new used record store opened right on Telegraph Avenue in Oakland called Stranded Records, which is it's a great little store. It's run by completely knowledgeable guys who love talking to the customers.
There you go.
And another one opened in downtown Oakland shortly thereafter. So that's two in the last year. You know, they may well go
Oakland,
out of business
though.
Eventually.
That's
true.
Oakland, Michael. Yeah.
But, you know, people, as long as there's cheap storefront real estate around and, you know, people with a little bit of money to invest in stocking a store, it can still happen. It's not out of reach. And meanwhile, turntables are selling better than ever, you know, better than they have in decades. And vinyl, new vinyl is kind of a de rigueur for bands that want to be cool and hip hop artists who want to maintain their cred. To release your work on vinyl is kind of obligatory at this point. So at least when it comes to records, you know, it's going to carry on for a little while longer. My daughter just left for college. And she took her little turntable with her and her.
You trained her well.
Yes, I did. Indeed.
That's not a bad thing. Yeah. Well, so when it comes to these two men in this record store, which is the genesis for Telegraph Avenue, there's a lot going on here. But give us a sense of the arc of this book and where you're going with it.
Well, as you mentioned, there are these two married couples at the center of it, Archie and Gwen, and Aviva and Nat. And Archie and Gwen are African-American, and he is one of the partners in the record store.
Mm-hmm.
And Gwen is a nurse midwife. And then she was partnered professionally with Aviva Roth Jaffe, who's married to Nat, who's the other partner in the record store. And the book confronts them essentially simultaneously with looming crises in all of their relationships and in the nature of the work that they do and they've been doing. In that we learn pretty much from the outset of the novel that imminently there's going to be open, and this is in the summer of 2004, I should mention, they're going to be open this huge, it's kind of a mega mini mall that's going to have a media store, which if history is any indicator based on the store that has already been opened down in Los Angeles, is going to include an amazing used vinyl section that is probably going to kill our guy's business. And as much as they might want to hate this dog pile media store that's coming in, it's tough for them because it's owned by a guy named Gibson Good, who's a former NFL quarterback, and he's the fifth richest black man in America. And he's motivated not simply by making a profit, but he's done this thing in LA where he opened one of these places in the middle of historically disadvantaged, distressed neighborhood, and it's turned over this neighborhood into this vibrant place. And now he wants to do it in the part of Oakland where our guy's record store, Brooklyn Records, is located. And, you know, he's not an evil, it's not an evil, faceless empire coming in.
Yeah.
And yet it is going to spell their doom. And meanwhile, Gwen and Aviva, the nurse midwives, in the course of doing a home birth, something goes wrong. And although the outcome is fine and everybody's okay, they get into trouble with the hospital, and who are sort of constantly out to take away their hospital privileges. And so their livelihoods and the nature of what they do is also threatened. And so are the two marriages. And then there are these two teenage boys at the heart of the book, too. One of them is Aviva and Nat's son, Julius, who's called Julie. And then the other, who's 14, and then there's another 14-year-old boy who's Archie's long-lost son, if you will, a son he knew about, but he's never recognized or had anything to do with, who shows up literally on his doorstep. And those boys form a relationship with each other. It is, you know, I think to me is actually kind of the heart of the story.
You want people to walk away from Telegraph Avenue with a little bit of what, Michael? What are you hoping they're salted with and they walk away?
More than anything else is just pleasure. I mean, you know, that's why I read. And that's when I write, that's what I'm hoping to inspire. You know, I look for pleasure in reading, a kind of pleasure that I don't get from doing anything else. And you know, to me, pleasure, I think we have a tendency to think of pleasure on this very kind of rudimentary, almost, you know, biological sense. But the pleasure that you take from reading, and especially from reading a piece of really good writing, is a really layered, nuanced pleasure that is more than just the kind of pleasure you might get from, you know, eating a ice cream or having a milkshake. It's a pleasure that comes from feeling that you are connected as you're reading, not only to these imaginary characters that you're reading about and getting a glimpse into somebody else's life and what it would be like to be somebody other than yourself, but also a sense of connection to the author, him or herself, and to be directly connected to another human imagination in a way that's, to my mind, simply impossible in any other means, is pleasurable. It feels good. And so, you know, that's it. That's what I would like people to just come out of the book thinking, that was fun. You know, I want to do that again.
Michael Chabon is our guest, the Pulitzer Prize-winning author. His latest work, Telegraph Avenue, now out in paperback. And if you want to join our conversation, perhaps you're a fan of Michael's work, 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. UpToDate@kcur.org is our email address. You can also tweet us at @KCURUpToDate. You know, I know you've been asked this a lot, but as I just marvel at guys like you who take on these books that sort of arc and dive and flow and ebb and in so many different directions. I'm a short form journalist, simple minded, you know, ridiculously, you know, simple minded guy. And yet you're doing this thing with this book where you've got 18 plates going at once. And I read somewhere about this particular book that you at some point you got into it and you were like, man, I don't know if I can make this thing go or not. And God, I could really, really imagine that feeling, having spent some time with this. Tell me about that point. Where were you, and how did you grapple with it, Michael?
Well, I mean, it happens with every book I've come to learn. And it's at some point,
for my two cents, it's an awful, awful place to be.
Oh, it's horrible.
It's the worst place.
Yes, I mean, you know, it takes me a long time to write a novel. It takes me many years, at least three, generally, and usually closer to four and a half, something like that. And it's just a really long time to sustain your interest, even when it's going smoothly, when it's going well. It can be tough to keep up the interest, and sometimes it's hard to remember why you ever thought you wanted to work on this particular project in the first place. But it's even worse when it's not going well. And, you know, there's usually at least once in the writing of every one of my novels where I suddenly gradually get to have this feeling of I don't want to be doing this anymore. Yeah. I don't understand I don't like my characters. I don't like this world. I made a wrong turn somewhere and I can't figure out where. And now I'm writing about something I don't want to be writing about, or I'm wandering. I'm reaching. It's a terrible feeling. And with this book, what really happened was, as I mentioned, I initially conceived it as a TV series, a potential TV series.
Yeah.
And nothing came of that, and I put it aside. And when I decided to go back to it, I foolishly thought that it was going to be easier because I had already written the script for a 2-hour pilot. So I had a 110-page script.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, well, I'll just take that script and, you know, essentially novelize it. I'll just sort of pad out the dialogue with some description, and probably this will just take me a few weeks. And, you know, I mean, it was essentially, it took me 2.5 years to realize that was wrong, and that isn't how you do it. And I couldn't work that way. And a script for a 2-hour pilot for a TV series bears no relation to a novel in terms of what you actually need to accomplish and what kind of story you need to tell. So I started over. I kept At first, I wanted to quit. My wife talked me out of it. She said, I really love what you're doing. I love these characters. I really love Archie and Gwen.
Would she tell you if she didn't love them?
Oh, yeah.
And she's direct enough
yes.
and
oh,
you,
yeah.
you guys roll that way, she would
mm-hmm.
say,
Yeah. No, I mean,
she's a novelist herself.
She is a novelist, yeah. and she is also a very direct person who does not pull punches. So
okay.
I've come to rely on her. I mean,
that's a marvelous
yeah,
thing.
Yeah, bless her for that. I need it. So I trusted her. And I just kept the essential situation, the record store, the midwifery practice, the couples, and some particulars, but I just reconceived. I'm going to start again, and and the threats to their two practices, if you will, to their businesses. I kept all that stuff, but I just started again with a new story and the character of Archie's son and Archie's father, who I haven't mentioned before, Luther Stallings, who's
yes.
kind of a washed up.
Yes.
Ex-star of blaxploitation films of the early 1970s. He was a karate champion, and I know he's a very magnetic, charismatic personality, but he's struggled for years with a bad drug problem, and now he's sort of trying to put his life back together, but in a kind of harebrained way, with good intentions, but still hasn't lost his delusions of grandeur. And he and Archie coming to terms, and Archie trying to come to terms with this son that he's never acknowledged mm-hmm. that, and the relationship between that boy and Archie and Gwen and that son, you know, those elements came into the book after that crisis and were really my the things I leaned on to pull myself out of that.
You know, how do you deal with those dark moments? I can remember, I don't think I'm out of line by mentioning Whitney Tyrrell, just a terrific novelist based here in Kansas City, and went to lunch with him once as he was sort of struggling, you know, to find another idea and struggling with a book, didn't really quite know where to mm-hmm. go with it. And I could just see, you know, the angst on his face. And again, as a journalist who operates on a far, far smaller level, I just know what that place is, mm-hmm. and you just don't want to be there very long because it'll consume you. You
right.
know?
Well, I mean, you know, personally, I tend to rely pretty strongly on denial. So you
what
know,
a great friend.
And yeah, that's my operating principle is just basically try to ignore trouble for as long as you possibly can and pretend it's not happening.
Yeah.
So, you know, that can be effective.
Go out and play football and not even think about
it. Right, exactly. Yeah. People say, how's your book going? You
great.
Just say fine. And
yeah.
But, you know, with my wife, I don't need to front like that. And, you know, we are collaborators both creatively and, you know, in our life partnership as well. And so, you know, she's the person that we are each the person the other one turns to when we're having problems and doubts and uncertainty, or we need help, or we just want to bounce ideas off somebody.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that makes it then easier for me to sort of keep up a brave front.
So when you approach a book like Telegraph Avenue, then, Michael, are you sort of sitting back and outlining this thing? You sit back and write a strict outline, as so many folks do, or are you just sort of rolling with this thing as the muse hits you?
Well, that makes it sound a lot more fun than it really is. I think I would probably use the word groping in
yeah.
the dark blindly while stubbing my toe repeatedly on things that I didn't know were there. You know, I should outline. I probably should outline, and I envy when I hear about writers who start out with these beautiful, carefully organized outlines. I'm envious, but I can't work that way. I feel when I do screenwriting, I'm obliged to outline, and I know what it's like to try to make a really good outline.
Because you have to outline when you screenwrite, because
they won't pay you unless they know what they're getting. So, you know, they typically, producers and studios, if they hire you to do a job, they want to see what you plan to do, and they want to, and they may make you go through draft after draft after draft just on the outline, and then they tend to say things like, you know, we're talking about a document that says, you know, he goes to the bank, but nobody's there, so he leaves, and you know, it's very rudimentary, and they'll tend to say things like, you know, I didn't really feel like the heartbreak, you know, in on step 4A, you know, and you have to. Outline, to me, I find it to be exhausting and dispiriting work. And in my own, when I'm just writing for myself, I feel that if the more I know about the story going into it, the less interest I have in telling it.
Oh, that's interesting. So that's interesting.
I need to be able to leave room to make discoveries. I mean, for me, it is, it's, you know, I said groping. I mean, it really is like that. I'm feeling my way into the story a little at a time, and it's very inefficient, and I waste a lot of pages and hours, and I end up throwing out stuff because it didn't get me anywhere. But that's how I do it.
Maybe it's something, there's a difference here between fiction and nonfiction. You know, Candace Millard, who wrote Theodore Roosevelt's River of Doubt, is also based here in Kansas City. And her method is, and boy, it works for her, clearly. You know, she spends a year in research, a year outlining, and then a year writing. For her, it's a very linear kind of thing. Mm-hmm. She has an office in her husband's office complex where she works, has her own place. And you get the sense for her, it's kabing, kaboom, kaboom. That's sort of how she rolls. Mm-hmm. But again, she's nonfiction.
Right.
And but her books are layered, and she always goes after subjects where there's lots of different things sort of happening. It's not a simple biography. There's other things going on. And so she's got to sort of grapple with it first. At least that's the sense I get from her.
Right.
And she's so disciplined about doing it that way, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I like I said, I envy that. But I'm just making it up as I go along.
I just admire it so much, yeah.
I mean, some people, I think, you know, it's when you're writing fiction, you're telling a lie. It's a lie, a very complicated, elaborate lie that you are telling. And what makes it to me, what makes it beautiful and wonderful, is you're telling it with the consent of the person you're lying to. The person to whom you're lying is saying, please, lie to me. I want to hear a lie. And you know, if you make it a good one, then I promise I'll believe you while you're telling it.
Does that devalue what you're trying to do?
Oh, I don't think so at all. I think that's what makes it wonderful. It's just like magic, you know, when you with a really gifted magician, you know, someone who comes up to you with holding a deck of cards and says you want to see a trick. Well, you know, they're not doing magic with a capital M. It's not Harry Potter, right? You know they don't possess some kind of mystical powers. You know they're fooling you.
Yeah.
That there's something that they're going to try to misdirect your attention so that you don't notice when they slip the extra card out of their sleeve or whatever it is. So you come to them fully giving your consent to being deceived, and they promise to completely deceive you. Now, I mean, I wouldn't have it any other way. That's what's so great about magic is that you're watching as hard as you can to see how they do it, and you still miss it.
You know, I used to do a little bit of that in a younger life, you know, kids' birthday parties and all that stuff. And, you know, I love magic, love what it can do. And it used to drive me crazy, the people who can't just roll with the effect. And
they
want to know how that was done.
Right.
Or you just did that. And they can't stand the idea that there's just, it's an illusion, and just roll with that and enjoy it for what it is.
Right.
So many folks can't handle that, you know?
Yeah, well, we can just pity them.
Yeah.
Because they're missing out, right?
That's exactly right.
I mean, there's plenty of people that say that I don't like to read fiction, and I only like to read nonfiction.
Yes.
I want stuff to be factual, and
yes.
you know, those are probably the same people who are saying, well, you had some fishing line sticking out of your pocket to the magician. You know, magicians laugh at those people.
Yeah.
You know, Charles Dickens wrote Charles Dickens fancied himself someone who could figure out how magic tricks were performed, and he left some writings where he diagnosed
and
they're totally wrong. I mean, like, they're legendarily mistaken, and so magicians enjoy that, those people.
Michael Chabon is our guest. We'll continue our conversation with him. Again, his new book, Telegraph Avenue, now out in paperback. Rave reviews for that book. And if you want to see Michael Chabon, you can do it tonight at Unity Temple on the Plaza. The event is sponsored by Rainy Day Books and Fairway. For a ticket to see Michael Chabon, 913-384-3126. Coming up later on this hour, Brian McTavish is here with your weekend to-do list. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. This hour, we're having a great conversation with Michael Chabon, his latest book, Telegraph Avenue. If you want to join our conversation, 816-235-2888, our email address, updodate@kcur.org. You can also tweet us at KCUR UpToDate. Again, he speaks tonight at 7 at Unity Temple on the Plaza. Call Rainy Day Books and Fairway for a ticket, 913 384 3126. Michael, your work ethic is well known to be extremely regimented. You write from 10 in the evening to 3 a.m. 5 days a week.
Right.
How do you do that, and how did you figure out that was the way you rolled best?
Well, you know, as soon as I was allowed to stay up as late as I wanted to, whatever age that was, I did. I'm just naturally a night owl.
That's your world.
I had always had a hard time falling asleep as a kid, and as soon as I didn't need to try to fall asleep, I didn't have that same issue. I didn't really start applying those hours to getting work done until I was in graduate school at University of California, Irvine, and I was sort of randomly assigned to housing with a fellow MFA student of mine who was 10 years older. His name's Louis Jones. He's a published novelist. And he had already at that point written 5 unpublished novels and had incredible work habits and would get up every morning at 6 o'clock, regardless of what we'd been up to the night before. Wow. If we'd stayed up till 3, you know, drinking and playing pool or whatever, he would still get up at 6. You know, and I'd be lying in my bed, and his room was across the hall, and I could smell his cigarettes because he smoked while he wrote, and then I could hear the keys of his keyboard clunking, and and it was just this reproach to me, like, look at you, you're just lying in bed, and that guy's up already doing his work. And so really out of a sense of shame,
yes,
you know, I started trying to have the same kind of regular approach to my work habits, but I could never get up at 6 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
Just not in my nature. So I started staying up late and doing my work at night, and just immediately, you know, this is in my early 20s, discovered that was the
time
to work
time.
For me.
So, and what's your workplace? Where is your workplace, and what's it look like?
I work in a studio space behind our house in Berkeley that I share with my wife. I yell at, we work different schedules, so sometimes we're in there working at the same time, but usually we're not. She works in the daytime. I work at night. You know, I would like to be able to work in the daytime, and I have tried many times to shift over, because when we have kids, you know, when you have kids, it's fun. I find it really fun in the morning. They get up. They're chipper.
Yeah.
You give them breakfast. You drive them to school. The house is really quiet after they go. It would be a good time to get work done. With my schedule, because I stay up late, I sleep late. When I get up, I've missed them already.
Yeah.
And then they come home after school. They're cranky. They have homework. Yeah. I have to make dinner. You know. But I just can't do it. I just can't be as productive in the daytime.
Is this a big space or a tight space, or
the studio that we share? It's nice size. It's not big.
Like, I've always seen pictures of David McCullough's work studio behind his home out in on the East Coast and Massachusetts or wherever he is, and it's like this little. It's like a dog. It's like the size of a dog house, you know. But it's taller, obviously. And it's like, man, how do you work in that kind of claustrophobic space
I think if you've got a window, you're probably okay. I don't know if his space has a window, but I've seen Roald Dahl's. You can find pictures on the internet of Roald. They've preserved where Roald Dahl worked, and it's really a hovel. It's shocking. It looks like an outhouse.
Yeah. he deserves better than that.
I guess he was happy there. Ours is quite a bit bigger than that. And, you know, it's
got windows.
It has windows and skylight, and it's got my books in it. And I work in an Ames chair. I like to be reclining with the keyboard in my lap and the screen on a little table at eye level. I was having trouble with my wrists and so on, and that was the cure.
Yeah. Okay, 816-235-2888. Michael Chabon is here. Let's go to Bob from Lawrence. Bob, you're on Up to Date. Good morning.
Hey, Steve. Good to hear you. And Michael, I hear you on the Night Owl thing. I was lucky enough to end up with a life of doing late night jazz radio, so I never had to work in the morning.
Perfect.
Anyway, love all your work that I've read, most of it, and I really love the secondary characters. And I have to say, in the new book, this is terrible because I read it right when it came out, so now it's been a while. I can't remember the name of the character, but the older P3 organ player.
Oh, Mr. Jones, Cochise Jones.
Yeah, exactly. But you really, to me, capture what it's like, because I've been around musicians my whole life and used to be a not very good one, what the feelings are of being in a band and or being a musician like this gentleman was. How did you get feel like you got inside that world. Plus the fact you explain Hammond B3 organ better than anybody else. I'd love to just give it to everybody that's always asking me about it.
Thank you. Thank you. Thanks, Bob. I appreciate it. Well, you know, part of the answer to your question is I listened to a lot of records while I was writing this book and got really deep into the world of the particular sort of subspecialty that my guys have in their record store.
I was going to say, you mentioned some Blue Note guys, and I'm really deep into that. And I'd never heard of some of the guys you talk about in this book, you know, but whatever.
There was this sort of last golden moment when jazz and the labels, the big commercial labels that supported jazz, kind of made this big last effort to regain chart position, if you will, for jazz, and to sort of make jazz the popular music that it had once been. And the, as had been the case in the past, the way of doing that seemed to be by making it music you could dance to. So the backbeat was sort of pushed forward again after, you know, a decade and a half of out jazz and you know, bebop, and the spawn of bebop, which was really kind of a music that was meant to be sat and to sit and listen to.
Right.
Musicians started bringing the drum and bass forward and produced this fantastic music from about, you know, say 67 to about 74 that has kind of carried on with an afterlife of its own. Well, in two ways. One, it sort of devolved into what is now called quiet storm jazz, or that kind of the jazz that like limo drivers put on in their car when they pick you up at the airport. But then it's also the records of that time found their way into the hands of hip hop DJs, and a lot of the greatest samples of the greatest hip hop tracks of the past couple of decades were lifted from albums from this period. So, you know, I listened to a lot of those records and a lot of organ, great organ music came out of that period. I just became fascinated with that instrument, with the Hammond B3 organ, and how it works. It's such a complicated, crazy instrument. The workings of the inside of a Leslie speaker cabinet are crazy and interesting. And it just was intrinsically something I felt like I could get into. And I don't play an instrument. I've never been in any kind of a jazz-related band. I have been in a band before in college, but it was like a punk rock band, and I wouldn't ever want to call what I did singing. But I do know how it felt. And in fact, my daughter, that I mentioned before, who just at college has just joined a band and is playing bass, and you know, they had their first rehearsal, and she called me up afterwards. She's so charged, I said to her, like, I remember like that time when I was in the band was without question one of the greatest periods in my entire life. Just to feel that you're part of that collaborative effort. And, you know, if you're not trying to make a lot of money by doing it and you're just doing it because you like playing music and being together and having fun and going for beer and pizza when you're done, and, you know, it's a great thing.
Do you still listen to that music now, that even though the book is done and been done for a while?
Yes, I do.
You got hooked.
I still do. I listen to a lot of it. And I listen to music constantly while working. I need to have music going, but it has to be just the right kind of music where it will – I don't want it to fade completely into the background, because then it might as well not be on at all. But it can't be too present either, or else I start listening to it too much. So,
you know, I really struggle with that. And as I get older, I'm having more trouble with music on in the background. Or, you know, I do the multi-screen thing, and I got TV going. And but I do find myself after a while I get kind of a headache, because I'm trying to focus, and then I can't focus if the music's on and the Royals game's on and all this stuff. And it's just, I sort of struggle with that sometimes. I want to be connected, but I don't want to be too connected,
well,
I guess.
What I find is that music, if it's the right kind of music, and lots of music turns out to be the right kind of music for me, and then way more turns out to be not right at all. But if it is the right kind of music, it helps me concentrate, because it sort of fills up a lot of the space around my head in some way that enables me to just look at the screen, hear the words that are emerging as they're emerging, and feel that I'm more focused.
Did you feel much pressure from your agent, from your editor, as you took several years to get this book done, Michael? Or is that a factor for you, or are you just going to get it done when it gets done?
You know, it is a factor coming out of my own head. I've always been fortunate in having editors, even though I've had a lot of editors over the years, none of them has ever put that kind of pressure on me. I don't know how common it is to put that kind of pressure on writers, but I've never experienced it. And I don't think I've ever made the deadline that I was supposed to. I think I've blown every single deadline of every book I've ever written, and it's never been
an issue.
An issue, yeah.
Is it hard for you having multiple editors? You don't have one guy who sort of has shepherded you through the labyrinth that is the world of books these days?
You know, it would be nice, and it would be nice because I've had great editors, and any one of them would have been nice to have had for the whole time I've been a writer, but it's just not how it works these days. And in a sense, you know, editors... it's hard for them to move up the ladder, and so the way that they move up the ladder is by switching to a different publishing house. So it's in their interest. It's, in a way, it's a little bit like, you know, baseball, where, you know, in the old days, you knew your team and you would have the same 7 out of 9 guys would be repeating season after season after season, and it became this presence in people's lives. And and it's not like that anymore. And it's sort of the same with editors. They do come and go more than they used to.
Just real quickly, the last question, Michael, Telegraph Avenue, why set in 2004? Why did you go to that? I mean, what was it about 2004 that grabbed you?
Well, I needed to have the threat of a big retail store coming into a neighborhood threatening, viable, and feel and what I realize is that the irony for the reader that's not apparent to any of the characters in the book in 2004 is that not only are our guys possibly doomed in this little record store, but this guy coming in with his big box store is also doomed. You know, that music is about to undergo this incredible digital revolution. And, you know, where are the Tower Records of, you know, today? Where are all the big corporate record chains? They're all
gone.
You know, and in fact, they're gone in the mom and pop stores. Some of them, at least, you know, a few of them are still here. And
irony of ironies. New ones. Well, again, Michael Chabon speaks tonight at 7 at Unity Temple on the Plaza. For tickets, call Rainy Day Books and Fairway. That number, 913-384-3126. Michael, it is always a pleasure to have you here. Thanks for taking some time with us.
Thank you, Steve. I really enjoyed it.
You bet.
Thanks a lot.